Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. I'd like to welcome all of you to the Michael Cutler Hour. Boy, there's an appropriate name for this program. I also wish everybody out there a very happy Veterans Day. And for those of you who are veterans or currently in the military or family members who have served our nation, we owe you a debt, folks, that we cannot repay you. We, the people, take our liberties for granted, our freedoms for granted, and freedom isn't free, and certainly the men and women of the military have made it possible, and that is, in this day and age, almost a thankless task, pardon me, when you realize how much the military does for us and how much little, as far as I'm concerned, in return that we do for the members of our military forces. So to all of you out there who have served our nation or whose family members have served our nation, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. My thoughts are certainly with you. There's an awful lot to talk about, and you know my focus is generally the immigration issue. And, of course, as I always like to remind people, immigration is not a single issue, folks, but it is a singular issue because border security and the way that we provide aliens with various benefits, including green cards and citizenship, has such a profound impact on every other challenge and threat that our nation faces today. And what is so astonishing is that you would think that in an era where we are threatened by the threat of terrorism, where we see more and more cities becoming infested with members of the drug cartels and transnational gangs, when you look at the violence in Mexico, when you look at the situation Mexico finds itself in, and other countries as well, you would think that our government would be serious about securing our nation's borders. You know, one of the things that I'm honored to do is I speak for a speaker's bureau. And in fact, if any of you out there are familiar with opportunities or aware of any opportunities, you can certainly reach me through my website, michaelcutler.net. Pardon me, I think Kermit the Frog is setting up residence in my throat tonight. And I would be delighted to discuss with you the potential for taking my show on the road, so to speak. But just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Washington. I had the distinct privilege and pleasure of addressing a bunch of Air Force officers, mostly lieutenant colonels, colonels, and generals. And I raised the issue with them that I will raise with you today, and it certainly is most appropriate on November 11th, Veterans Day, to ask this fundamental question. Why do we still have a military? And this is not as a way of slighting our armed forces or the gallant folks in the military, but let's think about why we have a military. Our military serves many purposes for our country, but I think we would all agree that job one for the U.S. military is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible. I know in The Godfather somebody was given some sage advice, keep your friends close, your enemies closer. But where the enemy is concerned, whether it's terrorists, whether it's rogue countries, you know, Iran working on nuclear bombs does not give me the incentive to get a good night's rest. We need to protect the country. We need to protect the homeland. And appropriately, if you think about homeland security, you think about the fact that the Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, are under that broad umbrella that they call the Department of Homeland Security. Meanwhile, our border leaks like a sieve. You listen to the politicians, with a couple of exceptions, even among the GOP candidates. They're all talking about, well, if these folks are here, we've got to deal with them and all this other happy nonsense. In point of fact, you cannot protect the country once you have people within that country without having any reliable way of knowing anything about them. We don't know their names. We don't know their nationalities. That means we know nothing about their backgrounds, their potential affiliation with criminal or terrorist organizations. We don't know if they pose a threat to community safety or if they pose a threat to national security. And we also know that they are taking the jobs of Americans, and at a time when I have to tell you, our economy is in the toilet. And it's remarkable that the government will tell you, the economists say, well, the recession ended in June of 2009 or July of 2009. So here we are more than 2 years later and the recession is over. you know, we all have favorite stores that we shop in. Today I went to one of my favorite stores where they prepare food and so forth, and they have really delicious food there. And I noticed that where on a Friday night the line would normally be out to the door and all the food would be gone from the showcases, as it were, the refrigerated glass-paneled refrigerators where they keep their merchandise, the prepared foods. Well, most of the food was still there. At the end of the day, you would expect that it would be bare, that most of the food would have been sold. These are small little barometers that all of us around this great country can see. Look at the for sale signs on houses. Look how long it takes to sell a house. Look at where the price of real estate has gone. Look at the way that food in the stores is not moving off the shelf, where, you know, it's a little bit upscale. The economy is not doing well. You don't need to be an economist. You don't need to get the Nobel Prize in economics to know that our country is hurting. We have never had more Americans out of work than right now. And this nonsense about a 9% unemployment rate, there was an interesting article in the Huffington Post where they talked about how, hey, listen, there's lots of people who have blown through their 99 weeks of unemployment. That means they are no longer statistically counted, but believe me, those folks do count. They count because they are our fellow Americans. And many of them, through no fault of their own, have lost their jobs, lost their homes, lost their capacity to support themselves and their families. And meanwhile, there are many politicians out there that talk about the need to provide illegal aliens with a pathway to citizenship, with green cards, with the authority to work in the United States. Why in blazes would anybody who represents the citizens of the United States talk about the need to provide employment opportunities to people who are here illegally? I want you folks to just stop and think about this. And I also want to know how this is a conservative issue. One of the problems that we have seen is that the other side, the open borders crowd, and I call them, and they truly are, immigration anarchists, have branded those of us who want secure borders with a title. And don't for a moment think that words don't have impact, ladies and gentlemen, because it does. When you are branded anti-immigrant, that is as close to being anti-American as you could imagine, especially in the psyche of this country. We are a nation of immigrants. When you think about symbols of the United States, one of the very first symbols that comes to mind is the Statue of Liberty and the Emma Lazarus poem, you know, the giant colossus, you know, give me your tired, your poor, and so forth. That is what we have been taught since day one the United States is about. So if somebody can successfully brand you as anti-immigrant, they've destroyed your credibility, and they have insulted you in ways that go beyond belief. And most people acquiesce, and they ignore that kind of branding. So let me tell you a theory that I have. Now, I wasn't a big fan of Michael Dukakis. You know, he ran for president a number of years ago. He ran against George Bush Sr. And if you remember, there were probably three reasons why Mike Dukakis lost the election. I mean, really, what contributed? Obviously, the American people didn't like him for a bunch of reasons, but there were three issues that I think did him the most harm. Number one, he was at a university and got on top of a tank trying to look macho and put on one of those tanker's helmets and wound up, for all the world, looking like Mickey Mouse. He just couldn't pull it off. So that was kind of a bad image. Minor point. There was Willie Horton, a guy who was in jail for murder, and there's Mike Dukakis, mishandling that case, making statements about how, you know, he wouldn't want to see this guy in jail and did all this other nonsense. So he came across looking weak on law enforcement. But I think the most damage that was inflicted to the Dukakis campaign was very cleverly, very astutely carried out by George Bush Sr. If you're old enough and if you remember, George Bush Sr. accused Michael Dukakis of being a liberal. Now, I know a lot of you folks in this audience are liberals. Are conservatives and have issues with liberals. I'm a registered Democrat. I consider myself a centrist. But in many ways, you might accuse me of being liberal. But I think all of us as Americans are entitled to our political perspectives. But when you run for office, you need to be able to substantiate to justify your position. After all, this guy wanted to be the president of the United States. And he turns around and he's told, you're a liberal, and Mike Dukakis spent the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, whatever it was, where every time he got in front of a microphone, he tried to convince people that he really wasn't so liberal after all. What George Bush had done with that strategy of his, and I don't think it was accidental, it was too brilliant to be an accident, he forced Mike Dukakis to run against himself. Peter Pan could separate himself from his shadow, but nobody else can. So there's Mike Dukakis trying to explain to potential voters why they should vote for him, because he's not really a liberal. What happened was he was defined by his political opponent. And any time that you permit your opponent to define who you are, you may as well take your marbles, pick them up, put them in your pocket, and go home because the game is over. The immigration anarchists who insist on opening the borders, on providing pathways to citizenship for millions of people, and we have no idea of knowing who they are or why they're here, have used this term anti-immigrant incessantly, and I've yet to hear anybody really stand up and take that issue on and say, wait one moment. And this is the point, folks. Are you really anti-immigrant if your sense of what is proper, right, moral, decent, and intelligent, you know, common sense, is to say, look, we're not going to just allow anybody to saunter across that border and set up shop in cities across the country, because that's what makes somebody an illegal alien. It's not about being against immigrants. It's about being against having people who are guilty of breaking and entering, of trespassing, of burglarizing America. But yet, we've seen politicians not take the issue on the way they needed to. Russell Pierce, the senator from Arizona, who was the firebrand, he was the motivation behind SB 1070, the Arizona immigration law, and I worked with Russell and his people. I came up with an extensive declaration in support of that state against the outrageous lawsuit filed by the Justice Department. Russell Pierce faced a recall election, and he lost it. And it's really sad and very unfortunate that he lost it, but I believe that in large measure he lost it because he really needed to go and do the right kind of combat with those people who were trying to vilify him. Look at what was happening in Arizona when SB 1070 was passed. You know, Arizona is a border state, but of course I will also tell you that every state in this country is a border state. You know, states on the northern border, states along the coastal regions, and states that have international airports are all border states. But Arizona sits on the southern border, the border that's supposed to separate the United States from Mexico and the madness that's going on in Mexico. That border is not secure, and I don't care what Janet Napolitano has to say. That border is wide open, and the evidence of it is the fact that there are more and more cities falling victim to the Mexican cartels, and the narcotics they peddle manage to get into our country. If the border was secure, they wouldn't be entering the country, and the narcotics wouldn't be getting here. It's like sitting in a boat, and you're rowing out on the lake, and the guy sitting next to you says, oh, this boat is watertight, you've got nothing to worry about. And you notice your feet are cold, and you look down and you realize you're up to your ankles in water. Don't tell me the boat is seaworthy or watertight. Well, when you realize how many illegal aliens are here and how the drugs keep flowing across the country and how gang members keep getting arrested in cities throughout the United States, they came across that supposed secure border. The border is not secure. But Arizona was paying a hell of a price. In Phoenix, Arizona, the state capital, they were averaging a kidnapping and or home invasion every single day. Think about that. A city in Arizona, the capital of that state, experiencing a home invasion or kidnapping on a daily basis. And most of the people kidnapped were members of the immigrant community. Most of the kidnappers were involved in the drug trade, and the drug trade emanates from Mexico. Well, you don't have to be a genius to figure this one out. The immigration laws that the open border advocates, the anarchists, will tell you are so evil are simply intended to keep foreign nationals out of our country if they pose a threat one way or another to our safety, well-being, and security. And if you look at the list of laws or the section of law, if you look at the categories of aliens who are supposed to be kept out, and this is something I'm very familiar with. Those of you who are familiar with me know that I worked for the INS for 30 years. For the first four of those years, I was an immigration inspector assigned to Kennedy Airport starting in 1971. And it starts out on that list that's enumerated in Title 8 of the United States Code, Section 212, and I'm not going to give you a law lecture, folks, but I want you to know that this is law-based. When you say someone is doing something illegal, it means they're violating the law. It's very simple. If you're in violation of law, then what you are doing is illegal. The immigration law is a very specific body of law, and as all law is, it sets out certain standards, certain categories of crimes and requirements and so forth. So the law says if you are somebody with a dangerous communicable disease, you are supposed to be kept out of the country. Incredibly, under this administration, by the way, people suffering from AIDS are no longer considered to be suffering from dangerous communicable diseases. I mean, I just want you to stop and think about it. It is stupefying. But for political reasons or for whatever reason, God only knows, AIDS is no longer considered, for the purpose of the Immigration Act, a disease that should keep anyone out of the United States. How many Americans have to die because of the stupidity perpetrated by our politicians? That's really what I want to know. But anyway, it's people with dangerous communicable diseases, people who suffer mental illness and are prone to violence, or the sex offenders, the pedophiles, that kind of thing. Convicted felons, drug smugglers, human traffickers, alien smugglers, money launderers, gang members, human rights violators, war criminals, spies, terrorists. There's a whole list of reasons why, by law, an alien is not supposed to be permitted into the United States. Okay? So when you say let's enforce the law, what you're really saying is let's keep out terrorists, let's keep out spies, let's keep out human rights violators, let's keep out war criminals and people who smuggle human beings and smuggle narcotics and are involved with violent gangs. That's really what it is that we're looking for. There isn't a single word in the immigration law that says let's keep out Mexicans, let's keep out whatever. It's not done that way. The immigration laws do not make any distinction whatsoever about race, religion, or ethnicity. And I would love to see somebody stand up and make a case for permitting aliens into the United States who are human rights violators, murderers, rapists, terrorists, money launderers, prostitutes, gang members. You know, let's go through that list. So when people scream, oh, my God, they want those laws enforced, my question is, well, why don't these folks want those laws enforced? When George Bush told Michael Dukakis that he was a liberal, what Michael Dukakis could have done, what Michael Dukakis should have done, what Michael Cutler would have done if I was running against George Bush, is you find a decent definition of the word liberal and say, okay, if this is what you mean by liberal, yeah, that describes me. Why aren't you? And you go back to the debate. Instead, very foolishly, and that tells me that he did not deserve to win the election for, you know, if there's any doubt, I think this proved it, he was flat-footed. He stood there and said, well, I'm not really a liberal. Well, he was a liberal, and much more so, I believe, than I am. But the point was, he did not defend himself by throwing the ball back at his opponent. He tried to defend himself by redefining who he was based on accusations made by his opponent. Those of us who want our nation's borders to be secure, who want our immigration laws to be enforced, need to do a little bit of homework, and I'm willing to help you with it. Please go to my website, michaelcutler.net. Please go to the Californians for Population Stabilization website. I do a lot of writing for them. They're a great group. Their website is capsweb.org. And what I do is lay out what the law says. If you're in a debate with somebody who is an immigration anarchist, you need to look them in the eye and say to them, is it okay that we let terrorists into the United States? Is it okay that we allow child molesters into the United States? Is it okay that we allow murderers into the United States? You see, because these are categories of aliens that the immigration laws are supposed to keep out of this country, and when they are found here, we are supposed to remove them from our midst. Is this about discrimination or about common sense? Is this about xenophobia or about a concern for the safety and well-being not only of our citizens but of our members of the immigrant communities? You see, that's wherein the problem lies. The public at large is dumb. And if you don't believe that the average American is dumb, back at Brooklyn College when I was a college student, we used to say the masses are asses. If you don't believe that the masses out there are dumb, realize that years ago somebody made a lot of money selling the pet rock. And if that wasn't dumb enough, they made even more money about a year later selling the training manual for the pet rock. So stop and understand what the immigration laws are supposed to be about. They're supposed to keep out the people who are a threat to our well-being, and they're also supposed to keep out people who, if they got jobs in our country, would do harm to the American worker. And then you have the politicians who want to provide illegal aliens with jobs at a time when jobs are scarce. Could you imagine? Could you imagine that? Could you imagine what would happen if, as a responsible parent, supposedly, you gave food to strangers and sent your own kids to bed hungry? If child welfare found out about it, how quickly would they come down on you like a ton of bricks and take that child out of your house and say, you know what, you're not taking care of your child? And they'd be right. How do we as a country justify providing employment opportunities at a time when Americans desperately need those employment opportunities? Jeffrey Immelt, the president of General Electric, was on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago, perhaps a month ago. He made a very interesting point. He said that when he posts 1,000 jobs for $15 to $17 per hour, he gets, get this number, folks, 50,000 applicants for those $15 an hour jobs. $15 an hour is not living opulently. If you're making $15 an hour, I assure you, you are not living high on the hog. Yet when they post 1,000 jobs at General Electric for $15 to $17 per hour, according to Jeffrey Immelt, he should know, he's the CEO of GE, he winds up with 50,000 applications. So if that's the case, explain this again to me, because I think I'm missing something here, and perhaps we all are. What need does America have for more workers when, if you were to bring those workers into our country or permit illegal aliens to join the legal workforce in our country, you will be bumping Americans off that line for those jobs? How is it anti-immigrant to say, look, we have the right, we have the moral imperative as a sovereign country to make certain that Americans get first dibs? You know, that's all that these laws are about. That's all that these laws are about. It's about keeping out the criminals, keeping out the terrorists, keeping out the people who pose a health threat, and keeping out the people who will wind up competing with Americans who are desperate for a job, for a job. And yet, the other side gets away with it every day of the week. They stand there and they say that those of us who want a secure border are anti-immigrant. We hear it from the President of the United States. We hear it from the political leaders, so-called, in our country. And in listening to the GOP debates, I have to tell you, the only candidate who stood there and said, we have Americans out of work, let's enforce these laws, has been Mitt Romney. I like what he has to say. I hope he means it. I hope he means it. Because too often we've elected people and, you know, we don't know if they mean it. But I am of the belief, having listened to him not only in this campaign cycle but in the previous one 4 years ago, I think he's serious. I think he gets it. When people can say that we have got to deal with the people who are already here, let me tell you something. That's a false argument. And, you know, we've gotten so bad at critical thinking in America, folks, that the other side not only has succeeded in identifying us and defining us, the other side also provides false choices, and so many Americans have been so dumbed down, are so focused on who's winning Dancing with the Stars, that they don't recognize a false choice when they hear one. Let me give you an example of a false choice. The other side claims there's 12 million illegals in this country. I think that the number is far, far, far higher. I think that that number, by the way, is probably closer to 30 or 40 million. But whatever the number is, the other side says, hey, you know what? We can't deport all these people. So we have to make them citizens. That's a false choice. In law enforcement, and you know, I spent a good part of my adult life as a federal agent, but in law enforcement, you're lucky if you get a couple of percent compliance. If you don't believe it, for those of you who are motorists, or if you get into a car regularly, how often do you speed and get away with it? How often when you're speeding do other people pass you and get away with it? I am willing to bet that it's only a fraction of 1% of all speeders who actually get stopped and issued a summons. So if I was one of these folks from the immigration movement, so-called, some movement, the argument should then be, well, you're only stopping a half of 1%. Obviously, there's a problem here. Obviously, if you can't give tickets to everyone, you should eliminate the speed laws. Isn't that the same kind of false choice? We can't deport them all, so we have to make them citizens. We can't summons all the speeders, so we need to eliminate the speed laws. It's crazy stuff. But when was the last time that you heard somebody stand up and fight back? When was the last time you heard a politician get up and fight back? One of my most disappointing moments so far in these debates came when Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, said something really outrageous, as did John Huntsman, and we'll talk about John Huntsman in a moment. But let's start with Rick Perry. And he didn't say it at just one debate, he said it at least two debates. When asked about a fence on the border, he said, well, if you built a fence along the border, people that want to go from Brownsville, Texas to Matamoros, Mexico would have to go 800 miles out of the way because you'd be blocking them off. Now, I want you to realize how incredible that statement is. I've actually been on that bridge that connects Matamoros with Brownsville, Texas. I went to Border Patrol Academy, and that was how you got into Mexico. We used to do that on weekends. I certainly wouldn't recommend it today. Matamoros is a hotbed for drug smuggling. But, you know, I was in the Border Patrol Academy back in 1972, and back then it was a routine deal. You'd go into Mexico. You'd have a cerveza, or you'd go to the souvenir shops or whatever. You'd do a little sightseeing. It was a way of breaking up the monotony of being at the academy on the weekends. But there's a border port there. You get inspected both ways, inspected going into Mexico by the Mexicans, get inspected coming back into Texas by both Texas Agriculture, as I recall, as well as by our own officials. Back then, you had the choice of customs or immigration. Today, of course, it's CBP, Customs and Border Protection, does that inspections. So to have the governor of a border state, Texas in particular, talking about a port of entry in his state, and saying, well, if you put up a fence, people would have to go 800 miles out of the way. Boy, if ever there was a dunderheaded statement, that's it. But nobody on that stage called him on it. Because the whole idea to the fence, folks, as you might imagine, is not to prevent people from entering through ports of entry, but to make certain that they enter through ports of entry. The fence would not go across the port of entry. It would just reinforce the areas between the ports of entry. And that parallels what we do in immigration. The immigration inspectors, the CBP inspectors, if you will, operate at ports of entry to determine whether or not to let foreign nationals into the United States and to determine that Americans coming back are in fact Americans and allow them in and perhaps make certain that they're not wanted by other law enforcement organizations for arrest. But that's part of the inspections process, and that's what the inspectors do. The mission of the Border Patrol is to interdict, to apprehend, to prevent people from evading the inspections process. That's the purpose to the fence. It's not to block off our borders. That's the dopiest thing I've heard in a long time, next to Jonathan Huntsman. Because Jonathan Huntsman, when asked about immigration, said, catch this one, well, if I become president, I will work with the governors of the four border states. Stop for a moment. Let those words sink in. If I am elected president, I will work with the governors of the four border states. Well, he obviously meant California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. Well, that's great. That's the states that border the Mexican border. What about the Canadian border? What about the coastal region? Do you know the United States has 95,000 miles of coastal region or coastline? And then you've got the international airports. It's estimated that 5 to 10 million illegal aliens are now present in our country who did not run the border. They came through ports of entry and then violated the terms of their admission. I did an interview with CNN about this. So when I hear this nonsense, I'm going to talk to the governors of the four border states, ignoring Canada altogether, ignoring the coastal region altogether. It takes my breath away. Somebody needs to send Jonathan Huntsman a map of the United States. But now here's the question. Why didn't anybody on stage, all these folks who want to be president, nobody called them on it? Nobody called Newt Gingrich on it when he said that he understood what went wrong with the amnesty of 1986 because he was working with President Reagan and knew that, you know, they just never had enough resources to enforce the law. But he also said, well, if someone's been living here and he's here 20 years and so on and so forth, then we need to give these folks a pathway. Well, if he really learned the lessons that the 86 amnesty should have taught him, then he should know how rampant fraud was in that whole system. We were told, and by we, I mean those of us who worked for the old INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, we were told that between 1 million to 1.3 million, 1.4 million, they were kind of fuzzy, illegal aliens would emerge from those proverbial shadows and be placed on a pathway to lawful status and ultimately citizenship. By the time the dust settled, we were looking at well over 3 million, perhaps approaching 4 million. Well, part of it may have been undercounting, maybe an intentional undercount. I mean, it's hard to imagine a politician lying, isn't it? But let's just, you know, go with that absurd possibility that, my gosh, a politician may have lied to us. Wow, what a thought that might be. And say, okay, so they knew there were going to be more than they said. But let's also look at another possibility, and this is really a big part of it. How many illegal aliens were able to falsely claim to have been present in the United States for the required amount of time so they would qualify, but in fact they weren't here that long? Realize the problem with adjudicating applications. And we hear this all the time. Well, what are we going to do with the people who are already here? What does that mean? You want to invite them to dinner? You want them to sleep in your guest room? What are we going to do with those who are already here? I mean, that goes back again to false choices and false arguments. So many people sit there, and they look like bobbleheads are nodding up and down. Oh, yeah, that's right. They're here. What do we do with them? Well, if they're here in violation of law, you make certain that they are unable to work. You know, a long time ago when I was on Lou Dobbs Tonight when he was at CNN, and I've said this before congressional hearings and elsewhere, I said that nobody would break into the amusement park if they couldn't get to go on the rides. No one stays at the amusement park at the end of the day when they turn off the lights and shut down the rides. Everybody heads for the exit. That's what you do with those who are here. You deny them the purpose for which they came. Let me ask you something, folks. If you go out to dinner tonight, you know, you decide you're going to have a late dinner with your friends or with your wife or your children or your husband or whomever, and you go to a restaurant, and you're sitting in the restaurant, and you're sitting in the restaurant, and then the owner comes out and says, folks, I don't know how to tell you this, but the refrigerator broke. We used up all the fresh food that we have. We are now out of food. How long would you sit in that restaurant once the owner of the restaurant made that announcement? We have nothing to serve you. Would you continue to sit there? or would you get up and leave and go elsewhere? In a manner of speaking, illegal aliens have to be told that there's no more food. We're not going to serve them. They're here for no purpose. They could sit here all they want. They're not going to get what they want. How long would that go on? That's what you do with those who are here already. This idea that you have an either-or is crazy stuff. It's a false argument, but how many Americans ever stop to think about what they're being told? How many Americans have the critical thinking capability to say, well, that's ridiculous. So what if they're here? They don't belong here. Do you go into your house and, God forbid, find a burglar and then say to the burglar, well, I've been away all week. When did you break in? And if the guy says, well, I just broke in 15 minutes ago. You got me. Then he gets arrested and put in jail. But if the guy says, well, I came here 2 weeks ago and I've been sleeping in your bed and eating your food, does that mean you have to adopt him now? Time has nothing to do with it. There is a provision in the law that if you are here for a certain amount of time, and I think we're up to 10 years now, and you could show that being removed from the United States would create a hardship for an American citizen, then if you can, we can determine that you have a clean history, we can deal with you as an individual so that perhaps you can stay here. And if we do it very selectively and very carefully, in a way that doesn't exhaust investigative resources so we can really know who we're dealing with, and perhaps I'll entertain that idea also. But if you're simply saying, if you're here illegally, all you need to do is show up at an immigration office and we'll put you on a pathway to citizenship, why on earth would anybody ever pay any serious attention to our nation's borders? Because you're going to have folks walking into an immigration office by the millions, and I'm willing to bet you that with those numbers and the way the agency operates, that the big thrust isn't on accuracy, it's on clearing the backlog, that they're going to say to people, you know what, just mail in the application and we'll take care of it. So you've got an illegal alien who claims he's used five different names. And I've seen this live and in person as an agent for 30 years. And you say to the guy, well, how did you come to use five names? Well, I moved into my apartment, and the electricity was already on, and when the bill came in the mail, I paid the bill, and I paid in cash. And the bill was made out to some woman. I don't know. Her name was Joan Walters. So I went down, and I paid Joan Walters' bill. So I used that name. And the gas was in the name of Sam Smith, so I went down there, and I paid the bill as Sam Smith. And there was a telephone in the apartment. There was a hardwired phone. And that guy's name was Roberto Gonzalez. So I paid the bill in that name. And then when I went to work, I borrowed a Social Security card. And I worked in three different jobs and used two different Social Security cards. Well, how do you even begin to determine how long that person has been here? There is no way of doing it short of a full field investigation, which I can tell you from personal experience is time-consuming. But if the goal is to clear the backlog, which is what the INS used to do, and now ICE and USCIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services, they're fixated on clearing the backlog. And by the way, you should know that if you deny an application, it will take you hours because you've got to write a report, you've got to justify it. You just can't say to somebody, nope, we're not going to give you what you want. It doesn't hold water in court. You have to write a report. An investigation was conducted, and we developed the following facts. And then you enumerate all the facts and explain why it's obvious that the guy is lying through his teeth. And then you can deny the application, and then he has the right to appeal it. Boy, is that a laborious process. And writing that report alone can take you a couple of hours, and you're going to have to maybe have someone go out and do an investigation. And now imagine if you wind up with 30 million applicants. 20 million applicants. Let's be real crazy optimists. And it might be a lot more than 30 million. How much time can we devote to investigating and writing reports for 30 million applications? Now, it may take hours or days to write a denial, but it takes 30 seconds to approve a petition. All you do is stamp it, and it says approved. And you initial it, and you put it in an envelope, and you send the thing to the guy, and the file goes back to the shelf with an approval notice in it. 30 seconds, a minute later, that file is done. It's off your desk. There's obviously no appeal coming. You are done with it. if your goal is to process as many of these files as possible, what's the most efficient way of doing it? Are you going to do a real investigation and conduct interviews and knock on doors? Or are you just going to grab that rubber stamp and see how many times you could smack that stamp against an application during your 8-hour shift on duty? The system is geared up. It is predisposed to approving applications. This is insanity, folks. This is a prescription for a national security calamity. We know that the terrorists who attacked our country depended on their ability to enter our country, because if they couldn't have gotten here, they couldn't have attacked us. And then they were counting on the ability to hide in plain sight. How better to hide in plain sight than to have permission to work in the United States so you can go to some nondescript job, make some money, which helps to subsidize your expenses here, while you plan to do damage to us. In fact, think about it. Almost every time that a terrorist gets arrested, don't they identify that terrorist by the job that he or she was doing the day he was arrested? Used car salesman, school bus driver, ice cream truck driver, limousine driver, taxi cab driver, airport bus driver. By the way, do you notice a pattern with the drivers? That's another reason why the driver's licenses are so darn important, and you don't want to issue them to illegal aliens who can't prove who they are. Because most of the time, not always, but very often, terrorists want a job that gives them two things, mobility as well as camouflage. If you go to Midtown Manhattan, the sea of yellow taxi cabs is astonishing. You drive a yellow cab or a black limo in Midtown Manhattan, nobody will see you. It is like living in a treehouse in a forest. And meanwhile, it provides mobility as well as camouflage. It provides the ability to have clandestine meetings. A guy gets in the back of a limo. A guy gets in the back of a cab. A guy approaches a guy selling ice cream on a street corner, selling coffee from one of those little vending wagons. How easy is it to put a memory chip in a little bag with that cup of coffee and slip the guy a memory chip wrapped in a dollar bill when you pay for that coffee? How easy is it to have a meeting in the back of that cab or that limo bus or whatever, the airport van? You see, this is the sort of job that terrorists love because it gives them those opportunities, and we keep providing the opportunities. And now you have a problem where the Obama administration has come up with a policy of using prosecutorial discretion to order their agents to not arrest illegal aliens. And from what I have seen from paperwork, statements made by the head of the ICE Union, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Union, they're even ordering immigration agents to not take illegal aliens into custody who've been deported and came back illegally afterwards. By the way, you should know that an alien who gets deported and comes back illegally has committed a 2-year felony. And if that alien has a criminal conviction, it becomes a maximum of 20 years in jail. I'm very familiar with it. I worked with Senator Al D'Amato back in the early 80s to create that aggravated felon statute for reentry to make it a 20-year max. And guess what's happened? The Obama administration has said, oh, no, hey, you're not going to arrest those folks. The guy has to have certain convictions for certain crimes or we can't be bothered. And we're going to tell the American people, oh, no, this is what we want to focus on, the bad guys. Well, if you're a terrorist, guess what the Obama administration just explained to you? If you want to come to the United States and carry out an attack, God forbid, you can run the border. If you don't get caught, that's cool. If you make your way to the interior of the United States, make your way to Chicago, make your way to Kansas City, make your way to Missouri, make your way to New York City or Washington, D.C. or Miami, Florida or Boston, Massachusetts or Seattle, Washington, as long as you don't have a criminal conviction, don't even worry about immigration because they've been ordered to not go near you. They won't even interview you. They will make believe you don't exist. It doesn't matter that you're illegally present in the country. Think about that. The administration has given aid and encouragement, as far as I'm concerned, to potential criminals and terrorists by establishing a policy for the agents who enforce the law, because at the end of the day, that's where the rubber meets the road. You know, people will sit there and dissect law ad nauseum. I see it happen all the time. Well, the law says this and the law says that. It doesn't matter what the law says. It matters if you have people out there who will enforce what the law says. You know, let me give you a real extreme example. Supposing there's real concern about people who speed, okay? And the mayor wants to curry favor with the voters in his magical town of Nevermore or wherever you want to call it, pick some town. And he says, if you're caught speeding, you're going to get jail for life. And everyone says, oh, my God, I don't want to go into that town because, you know, if I go 5 miles over the limit, I'm liable to go away forever. But what you don't know is that the police officers have been told they are not to make car stops. And by the way, they may have radar detectors in the window, but they cut the power cord. So those radar detectors don't work. Is anybody going to get stopped for speeding? Absolutely not. So on paper, oh, my God, if you're caught speeding, you're going to get life in jail. They're going to take your car. They're going to take your house. And it doesn't matter, folks, because the cops have been told to not make car stops, and their radar detectors have been rendered worthless. They're nothing more than huge paperweights because they disconnected the wire. But on paper, the mayor can stand there and say, look at what we've done for you. We are going to make sure that we get those speeders. But they're not going to, and the mayor knows it. Why aren't they going to? Because he saw to it that the cops would not do anything about it. That's what the Obama administration has now done. And Lamar Smith, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, has now subpoenaed the records of Janet Napolitano, the head of what I call the Department of Homeland Surrender, and said, we want to know who in blazes you are not arresting. We want to know who is getting deported. We want to see the files of aliens who were supposed to be deported, and you vacated the process. You stopped their deportation. This is going to get very interesting very quickly. You know, prosecutorial discretion, I've written about it. It's on my website, michaelcutler.net. It's on capsweb.org. I've written about this in a number of places. Prosecutorial discretion is a viable tool for law enforcement under certain conditions. It's a viable tool if you're doing it so that you don't do things that make no sense. For example, in New York City, and there are towns that have speed traps, and you try to avoid them like the plague, because you know that these cash-strapped towns use the motor vehicle laws as simply a way of generating money, so they catch you going 2 miles an hour over the speed limit, they give you a summons, and it's a mess. In New York, they don't do that, thankfully. I know, for example, that the speed limit is 50 miles an hour on the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn and Queens. But you know what? If I go 60 miles an hour, 10 miles over the limit, and I don't tailgate, and I'm not cutting in and out of traffic, and the road is clear, and the road is dry, and everything is fine with the world, and I'm not bothering anybody, it would be almost impossible to imagine being pulled over by a police officer for speeding, because I'm not creating a threat to public safety, and that's the way it operates. So everybody in New York City tends to go 60 miles an hour on that Belt Parkway that's posted as a 50-mile road. That's prosecutorial discretion. Could the cop stop you? Absolutely. Could he issue you a summons? Absolutely. Would it stand up in court? Absolutely. Would it be fair? Not so much. So the cops say, okay, we'll give you 10 miles an hour or 11 or whatever it is. That's prosecutorial discretion. You know, a guy gets caught with a marijuana joint and the judge says, you know, we'll let him plead guilty to a misdemeanor and we'll give him an acquittal contemplating dismissal, as they call them in New York, an ACD, and the guy goes on with his life. Maybe, if there's no other extenuating circumstances. Is that prosecutorial discretion? Yes. But the concern that we all have to have is the same concern that Internal Affairs has with the New York City Police Department. If a cop pulls someone over and doesn't issue a summons, why didn't he issue a summons? Why did he issue a warning or a stern lecture? Was it that the guy wasn't quite doing something bad enough to get a ticket, in which case the police officer was exercising fair and appropriate prosecutorial discretion? Or did the cop take a $20 bill or a $50 bill from the motorist? Now, the reason I raise this question is my concern is what has motivated the Obama administration. Because the way they are applying prosecutorial discretion gives me, frankly, cause for pause. Are they doing it purely to focus only on the bad guys? And we could talk about how this is a flawed way of doing business, because I've also often made the case that we should prioritize criminals over non-criminals. This is a triage and go after the most serious problem. So if he's simply doing it and thinks, well, this is the best way to prioritize, I may not like it, but that's not terrible. It's just dumb. But what if the administration sat down and did the calculus and said, you know, if we can issue these policy decisions, we're going to make people who are the immigration anarchists, as I call them, the open borders crowd, happy. And if they're happy, they're going to give us campaign contributions. If they're happy, they're likely to tell people who vote to vote for me. Well, now we're no longer talking about prosecutorial discretion so that we are certain to focus on the bad guys, but we are using prosecutorial discretion in that instance to further a political agenda, and that is at least as bad and probably lots worse than the cop who doesn't give a summons to a motorist because the motorist gave him a $50 bill. Because now we're talking about political corruption. And I have a feeling, because I think Lamar Smith is pretty savvy, that that's exactly what Chairman Smith is looking at. So he has gone to Napolitano and said, I want to know why you're doing this and who you're doing it for. And by the way, I need to see the files. Now, what's incredible is the Democrats have lined up and said, oh, you can't do that. This isn't fair. They were going to cooperate. Let me tell you something. I'm a registered Democrat. I can't tell you the last time I voted for a Democrat, but I am registered as a Democrat. I have issues with the Republicans. I have issues with all the parties, and I think most Americans in this day and age do. But I will tell you about a gentleman by the name of John Hostetler and Lamar Smith and Steve King. And Steve King is certainly one of my heroes. Who, when President Bush, a Republican, was in the Oval Office, they took him to task for what he did and did not do where border security and the immigration laws were concerned. They went head-to-head with a president from their own party. And what's astonishing to me is that the Democrats aren't willing to do that. They're not looking at this and saying, you know, we live in a dangerous era. We're looking at Americans who are out of work. We're looking at terrorists possibly entering our country to prepare to hurt us. We're looking at increasing numbers of the cartels coming to the United States. We have to enforce the immigration laws. Now, it doesn't mean that every day you're out there looking for people who are working as dishwashers, and we used to do that when I was a new agent. I thought that was a terrible waste of resources. But what you should do, if I was running ICE, if I was running DHS, is just say, look, if you have a warrant for a guy who's a serious criminal and you knock on the door and the guy you're looking for isn't there because he moved 6 months ago, but there's another guy in that apartment who has no criminal history, but he is an illegal alien, then you take that guy into custody and you seek his removal. And you know why you do it, folks? Because now you're sending a message that even if you get past the Border Patrol, you run the border, you survive that whole ordeal, you can't put your head down on the pillow at night, secure in the idea that somehow the flying fickle finger of fate won't land on your square, and you wind up getting identified as being an illegal alien, and as a consequence, wind up getting deported. Because now you are fulfilling the requirement of deterrence. What that nitwit, and I have to say it, and you know, I spare no words, this is serious stuff, what Nancy Pelosi refers to as a climate of fear in law enforcement is referred to as a climate of deterrence, to deter people from wantonly disobeying our laws. That would make sense. Yes, we will focus our attention, our resources on the bad guys, but if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you don't have any guarantees either. That would be appropriate prosecutorial discretion. You know, I hope what I'm giving you is helpful, folks. No one has called in this evening. By the way, if someone would like to, my number here is 310-982-4145, 310-982-4145. But what I want to do is arm you with information, because my frustration, quite frankly, is that if you watch television, and I've done so many television programs, of late, TV has not really been covering these issues about interior enforcement and prosecutorial discretion, and how the FBI issued a report recently detailing how more and more gang members are operating inside our country. You know, this is the sort of stuff that gives me a fit, because these are critical issues. This is an election cycle. We are well underway now. The debates are getting serious. Immigration has to be a primary area of concern, not because of xenophobia, as the other side would say, not because of bigotry, as the other side would say, but simply because, especially in this perilous era when we're worrying about terrorism, transnational criminals, drug traffickers, and the economy, the point is that immigration hammers each and every one of those crucial areas of concern. And until and unless our nation addresses these challenges effectively, we are going to be in deep trouble. There is no way that we can protect our nation. I don't care what equipment we give to the Air Force and the Navy and the Marines and the Army and the Coast Guard. It doesn't matter. Because once you allow bad guys into our country, as we saw on September 11th, 2001, once they are embedded in our country, then they just have to put their plan together, and we are in deep trouble. The same thing with the cartels, and the same thing with jobs. Let's remember, folks, that the Labor Department used to be in charge of the Immigration Service. They were the ones who administered and enforced the immigration laws, because there was an understanding that if you flooded the labor market with lots and lots and lots of foreign workers, you would drive down wages and destroy the middle class. You know, at the beginning of my program tonight, I was talking about this view about Emma Lazarus and the Statue of Liberty, and we're a nation of immigrants, and give me your tired, your poor. I was on a program not long ago, and some young lady called in and said, well, you know, in the old days they let people in, and now they don't want to. And, well, yes, at the turn of the last century, at the time that the statue was erected, we had a very different country. We had a country that had a huge need for manual labor, whether it was in the farm fields or in the factories. We had a big country to settle. We only had a fraction of the number of people living there, in this country, living here, as we do today. I mean, the world just hit the 7 billion mark. That's a lot of human beings. And more people means more demand for food and water, and we're running out of water on this planet. And there will be more pressure, increasing pressure on our nation's borders as the world situation deteriorates, as the population continues to blow up. So you have to look at that. But you also have to understand that what built America wasn't simply having lots of people charging across our border. As I've spoken about in the past, Ellis Island was a quarantine station. The purpose of Ellis Island was to make certain that we did not admit aliens into our country who had dangerous diseases. And back then, when Ellis Island was opened, they didn't have the sophisticated medical testing where you could take a blood test or run a CAT scan or an MRI. And, you know, within 24 hours, you have a good handle on the person's health situation. Back then, the best thing they could do was literally let someone stew in their juices, you know. They have a little rash, you put them in a bed somewhere, and you wait a couple of weeks and see if their eyes pop out of their head. You know, that was the kind of deal. Because the concern was not letting people in who would do harm to us. And the other thing that made America America was the fact that our free enterprise system and our way of government, our Constitution, provided all these opportunities. Today, it's increasingly difficult to be the success story. We have a downturn in the economy. It's not just us. It's throughout Europe as well. It's hammering us. It's hammering our families. You know, we say a pledge of allegiance to the American flag as Americans. Hasn't the time come for our political leaders and our own government to say a pledge of allegiance to the citizens of this nation? To reaffirm the fact that our government is a government of the people and by the people and for the people? It's here to serve the people. And the people we're talking about all have one thing in common. It's not about race. It's not about religion. It's not about ethnicity. we the people, are citizens of the United States. So we come back to, again, fundamental use of language. The immigration anarchists, the open borders crowd, get very upset with the word alien because it provides clarity to the debate. Oh, my God, you can't use that word. It's an insulting term. It's a terrible word. For those of you who don't know it, the term alien, by law, is simply defined as being any person who is not a citizen or national of the United States. There is no insult in that definition, only clarity. And if we as Americans travel anywhere else, guess what happens to us? We magically become transformed into aliens ourselves. If you want to know what it's like to be an alien, drive up to Canada, across the border, and you will become an alien. Go to Mexico, go to England, go to France, Germany, Spain, go to Asia, go wherever it is that you're not a citizen. And as soon as you enter into the lands of that country, guess what, boys and girls? You will be an alien. And I assure you, I promise you, those other countries will not have one iota of problem telling you that you are an alien. You know, Mexico screams bloody murder about the fact that we want to build a fence and, you know, we secure our borders. Do you know the Mexican government has erected a fence on the border that's supposed to separate Guatemala from Mexico? And in Mexico, they don't use the word alien because they speak Spanish. They use the word extranjero. An extranjero can translate into stranger, foreigner, or alien. So, you know, let's really focus on what's at stake. Let's focus on what should be expected of our elected representatives. I'm sorry that that Russell Pierce lost that recall election. I hope he decides to run for election at the next election, which I think is a year away. And then hopefully he will. I hope to speak with the guy. I think he's trying to do a good job. But let's understand the way that the language has been used so deceptively. And let's stop allowing those who oppose us to define us. That's something that we should never, ever permit to happen. We need to define ourselves. And as far as I'm concerned, having seen the harm done to members of the immigrant community by aliens who should not be here, if you really want to support America's immigrants, then you want to enforce America's immigration laws. Because the most likely victim of ethnic organized crime groups, and this isn't just about Mexicans or even Latin America, it's not just about MS-13. It's about the Russian mob, it's about Asian organized crime, it's about the mafia. The most likely victims of the violence, of the extortion, are the members of the immigrant community, of all races, all religions, and all ethnicities. And you should know that transnational gangs are called transnational because they operate in two or more countries at the same time. So they are in the position to go to a member of an immigrant community, again, from any one of those groups that we've talked about and others, and tell them, you know, you probably saw what happened last night. If you go to the cops, we're going to find your brother who lives in whatever town. It could be Moscow. It could be Guadalajara. It could be Kingston, Jamaica. Doesn't matter. We see this in every immigrant community. Go to the police. We'll find your brother. Or don't take this suitcase to my buddy in Chicago, and you'll never talk to your mother again. They do this every day of the week. They use it as a way of intimidating people. And think how horrific that is. Somebody living in another country admires America, says, wow, that's where I want to go. That's the story of so many of our families. That's why my mom came here fleeing the horrors of the Holocaust. My dad's parents came here because they couldn't stand what was going on in Russia with the Tsar at the time. Now, imagine you come to the United States thinking, wow, this is my life's dream. For years, I waited for this moment. I'm here. Pinch me. I'm here. And they go into their modest little apartment, and they've moved to America. They're all excited. Wow, this is it. I'm starting my life all over. And to their horror, they find out that the same thugs who kept them awake at night in their home country are here. And they're plying their trades and making these lawful immigrants' lives miserable. And the other side says that we're anti-immigrant. make it clear, the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. It's wonderful that we have people come and visit the United States and spend money and learn about us. I think trade is good. I think commerce is good. I think people understanding each other helps. But we have the right to screen out those people who pose a threat. Just the same way we do as homeowners or apartment dwellers. That's why there's a peephole on your front door, folks. So when a stranger rings the doorbell, and that's why there's a doorbell or a door-knocking device or whatever on your front door, so that a stranger seeking to come in has a standardized way of announcing his or her presence, so you have absolutely the right to say, yes, come on in, or go away. You have every right to say, go away. America also has every right to say, go away, if the person that is seeking to enter would pose a problem or a threat for us or our nation. That's what it's about. Folks, we've got to stand tall. We have to have the courage of our convictions, and we have to be very clear in confronting those who are doing so much damage because of why they're doing it too, by the way. If you look at the motivation, all those groups are looking for two things. They're looking for money and they're looking for political power. The more illegal aliens that they can line up, the more contributions they get, the more political leverage they get, which means more power, which means more money, which means more power. Those of us who want secure borders don't make money off of these folks. But look at the people who do, whether it's the immigration lawyers, whether it's the politicians looking for campaign contributions, whether it's unscrupulous employers who want cheap exploitable labor, whether it's the banks who want to move their money and get a piece of the action. So in so doing, they become their silent partner. There are so many people lining up to exploit some very vulnerable people, and they have the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, to accuse us of being anti-immigrant when nothing could be further from the truth. I'm glad you spent this hour with me. I hope it's informative for you and interesting. It's my intention to bring you information that you're not getting anywhere else, whether it's by my discussing it with you, and I always welcome phone calls. Next time, please make a point of calling in. Love to talk to you. Or bringing you guests who have an unusual inside view of a particular issue that needs to be explored and exposed. There's so much happening. Fast and Furious is unwinding. I wonder how well Eric Holder sleeps at night, because it really seems that the flying fickle finger of fate is landing on his square. I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for him to avoid the consequences of this terrible investigation that caused the death, in my view, of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, probably Jaime Zapata, the ICE agent who was killed in Mexico by those guns that were turned over for God knows what reason to the members of the Mexican drug cartels. Lots of problems, folks. Lots of problems that need to be resolved, because nothing less than the survival of our nation and the lives of our citizens hang in the balance. I want to remind all of you that democracy is not a spectator sport. When we go to restaurants, we're very specific about the food we want to eat, the way we want it prepared. We need to be no less specific where our elected representatives are concerned. We need to make certain that they come to understand that we are not as dumb as they hope that we are. That's the job we, the people, must do. And again, today being November 11th, Veterans Day, the best way to honor those veterans who, through the history of this country, built this country, guaranteed us our freedoms, our way of life, the best tribute we can pay to them is for us to be the best possible citizens that we know how to be. And being good citizens involves more than voting, and certainly that is a critical part of it. But it also means that you reach out to your elected representatives on all levels, city, state, federal, and make certain that they understand where you stand and what your concerns are. That is our obligation, and I hope that we all fulfill that obligation, because it would make this country a far better place for everyone who's here. Thank you so much for your time, folks. Again, I wish all of you a very good weekend and happy Veterans Day. Look forward to the next time we get together. Good night, everybody.